can follow your own technological setup. Okay. All right. I was glad that she had a chance to introduce me, so I didn't really need to have to do it for myself. But the presentation today is called Classroom Without Walls, and this is to present a pilot project that we just completed a two-year experience with in the state of Alaska with a group of very unique healthcare workers who provide primary care in our Alaska villages. And this is something I've been doing for the last 25 plus years, and have had an opportunity to help the program grow. And as our first slide, I will also state for the record that none of the presenters or organizers of this have any financial or commercial interest in this presentation. Okay, we'll be covering four objectives today. One is to describe the barriers to primary health care in the state of Alaska among our Alaska Natives and why these cause health disparities amongst our population. Then we're going to discuss a bit about the history and training of the community health aides, which is a partial solution to the disparities of health care. We're going to introduce the success of the ability to teach clinical skills through a distance education format. And then finally, we're going to describe the impact of that distance learning on the community health aides themselves and how that helped with the health disparities that we were seeing in Alaska Native villages. So first, we're going to talk about the barriers. And for those of you who don't know very much about the state of Alaska, it's been in the news lately, and we can see Russia from there. And actually, I have this really lovely slide I was going to show you geographically why that's not such a funny slide, because the biggest barrier we have to the access to healthcare is our geography. It is a huge state. It has probably every type of climate there, and we have the Alaska Native villages are spread all across that state, and one of the vast things that happens is there's wilderness between them with no roads. We do have some larger communities that have some road connections, but they don't go to most of those Alaska Native villages where the people there live with virtually no access other than planes, snow machines, boats, and an occasional dog sled. And so I just kind of want to show you a little bit of what we mean by remote. Now, if you didn't have the fog, you might be able to see Russia from there. I believe that's the Chukchi Sea. And there's a combination of old tents, skin tents, and snow machines. And let's see if we can go back a slide. I'm not sure if we can do that. Oh, that does it. Okay. The other barriers to health, good health in the Alaska Native communities have some history in the social situation that goes on in the villages, and some of the differences in generations in the social and cultural experiences of our Alaska Native people. They have had their families disrupted by health problems such as influenza at the turn of the 20th century and tuberculosis in the 1950s, which literally tore families apart as people went to hospitals for several years of treatment if they survived, and that by itself has disrupted the social and cultural fabric of our Native communities. The other social and cultural influences were the boarding schools that took the children out of the home and sent them for all of their education into boarding schools in other parts of the state and sometimes outside the boundaries of the state of Alaska as well. Socioeconomic disparities also have a huge impact on the health of Alaska Natives in the villages, because there's not really any economy out there to keep the clinics villages going, except for a few basic jobs, and it turns out that one of the jobs is in the clinics. But access to health care comes at a great distance because the regional health centers that they refer to are many miles away without direct transportation. It is very costly to get health care to leave a village and go to a regional hospital. It is also extremely expensive to send one of the students that I have in from their village to take their training with us. And as we go along, if you kind of stop to think that each time a student comes to one of my training classes, it costs upwards of $20,000 or more dollars for them to sit in class for one of our sessions. So it's a relative barrier to them being able to receive health care just because of how far away they are. I'm going to tell you a little bit about who the health aides are. These health aides are entry-level medical care providers, and they're unique to Alaska in that they are the only non-licensed health care providers in the United States at all. They have been actually celebrating this is our 40th year as a federal program, and it's the only one of its kind in the United States, and a model that other people have looked at to see why does this work so well. So I'll tell you a little bit about it. They actually do provide primary care and emergency care from clinics in these Alaska Native villages, and there's approximately 200 villages spread out all over the state of Alaska. Okay. The history of the health aid training process, because this is kind of the piece of it that I work with, is that initially the health aide was a volunteer. And back in the 1950s, these were folks that were asked to volunteer from their communities to go door-to-door and help the public health nurses deliver TB medications to the patients and to help in following up with carriers and contacts. Over the years, they became the de facto communication between the medical system and the village itself. And so they became the people that the villagers went to when they had any kind of health concern. And the physicians who might make a visit to those villages once a year would hear from these villagers, often on satellite radios when technology started to come in. It wasn't enough. So it was proposed then that we actually start to formally fund this program and train these people to do actual skills. So the first trainers went out to the villages one-on-one. They packed a bag and they traveled out to the villages, and each individual health aide got something different, and it was primarily nursing skills. When they decided to formalize the program in 1968, it became a decision to actually train them in doing more direct medical care and intervention. And at the same time, regional training centers grew up to help students come into the centers and train them in doing something much more standardized all across the state. But it required a lot of travel. Okay. Each of these training centers now, we have four of them in the state, each is in a region that has a separate cultural experience. And we are not a homogenous state in terms of Alaska Native cultures. There are many different cultures and languages in the Alaska Native population. So each of these training centers exists in an area that has its own separate culture. But any individual health aide could go to any one of those four training centers and be interested in getting the same curriculum but being exposed to different cultures. And here's what it would look like if you superimpose the state of Alaska over the United States. This is where, how big we are and where our training centers would be located. We have a training center in Nome. We have one in Bethel. We have the one I work at in Anchorage, and we have one in Sitka. And each of these areas, Nome represents a group of Inupiat Eskimo, Bethel represents a group of Yupik Eskimo, Sitka represents a group of Tlingit, Haida, and Tsimshian Indian tribes, and here in Anchorage, we are most centrally located with Athabascan Indian tribes. And we are all different cultures and different languages. But we all have to learn medical care and medical language, and there is another interesting barrier, because each of our students has to learn how to speak with a physician. Okay. The success of teaching these clinical skills then via distance delivery with an entry-level community health aide was something that is quite new and an experiment, and we weren't sure if it would actually work, but it seemed like a good idea. So why we thought it might be a good fit is the tribes really wanted to get involved with technology and bring it out to the villages. They wanted to, and they went out and they got grants, and they asked for partnerships from our organization to actually put our curriculum out there and do it through distance learning. Technology was suddenly available out in the villages because we have a project throughout the state of delivering a consultation through telemedicine that brought telemedicine carts to each individual clinic that also brought the T1 lines and the ability to pass a lot of electronic information at the same time. There was also the happy coincidence of having grants and resources available to develop just this kind of training. We were also fortunate that our curriculum is now established, been established for quite a long time, and it has a lot of performance measure outcomes for each clinical unit that we have, so that we didn't have to reinvent or rewrite a curriculum from scratch. The other thing that we've suddenly found available was a few consultants we could call on and we could hire to help us learn how to do this, because within our program we had no expertise, and that was one of our biggest barriers right there. Was it going to be a good fit? Well, we had to fight ourselves, because within our training centers we have a lot of expertise in our Alaska Native population and how to put across face-to-face training, but we had a system that was finally working pretty well and we were running as hard as we could. How were we going to do this and learn something? We didn't have the skills and the knowledge within our base of professionals to try distance learning. So, skepticism. The professionals are skeptical that it can work, and unfortunately that meant we had a kind of built-in bias that we didn't think that our Alaska Native population could use a computer. Now that was an interesting revelation. I'm afraid to tell you this, but our students come in texting each other and they've got MySpace and Facebook down, and I'm looking at this going, boy, are we behind the power curve. But our instructors and our program that had carried this and created this curriculum and got it to this steady state were afraid of change. And does that sound unusual? No, it's pretty predictable. However, we felt that distance learning was a logical fit for health aides so that they could receive their training where they live. That it would also be a method consistent with their cultural values and the way that they learn, which is very much observing and then doing, cooperating and sharing, and assisting and helping each other, as opposed to what is a standard university-type curriculum where it tends to be competitive. Okay. Distance learning also has a way of engaging multiple sensory styles of learning, which is kind of an adult learning theory thing. But I could tell you that people are much more interested in watching videos, in hearing tapes, in putting things together and doing them themselves than they are to sitting in a lecture. And that was actually quite a fun thing to learn how to do. So we were able to translate our static curricula, our paper curriculum, into participative learning experiences for our students and put them up online and have them gain content and skills acquisition through distance learning and be able to turn around and apply it right away in their own setting. But the most important thing that distance learning did is it made the learning the responsibility of the student rather than the teacher. And this was one of the things that was the hardest thing and still is actually quite a challenge for our training center instructors to do, is to let go of the responsibility a little bit. Okay. Our curriculum has three types of activities. They have the didactic content, which is factual information you can look up in books, you know, and this is kind of what we sit in lectures to hear. It was skills acquisition, and it was direct patient encounters. Our challenge was to present this and evaluate the student's performance from a distance. As well as they have to learn it, we have to evaluate it from a distance. So our didactic classes, we combined what's called asynchronous and synchronous presentations. For the asynchronous means they can get into the material anytime they want to. We have a website that we created the assignments and we posted them for them on a learning management system called Moodle. And at some point in the future, if you're interested in learning more about what that did for us, we'll be able to answer some questions about that. The synchronous learning, which is everything happens at the same time and we're all together in it, we chose to use a break down those walls of the classroom and do it on video conference where the students all could see each other from their home clinics all over the state, if that's where they existed, and they would build a sense of class and a community of learners together. We used that primarily to demonstrate skills and to watch them do them in return, and then we could evaluate them and each of the students could give them direct feedback. And the students learned more from giving each other feedback than from listening to us talk to them. The students' peer evaluation then was a real key piece of this. We also did scenario-based training, creating scenarios, and they practiced taking histories, doing exams, and we all worked together to figure out what's going on and how would we consult to get an answer. So an example, for instance, of an online assignment would be the anatomy section. Almost every medical course has got something about the human body in it, and the human body hasn't changed in centuries, so it's pretty straightforward didactic content. We created some original slideshows and exercises to give them experience in human anatomy and medical terminology, and then I linked them up to interesting websites that are offered actually out there on the internet. In various universities put these on, and they're available for you to link into. They gave them games and gave them models and things that they could play with and do, and then they could recreate the assignments, upload them, and send them to me, and I could see the work that they had done. We also created audio and video files so that they could learn to listen to lung sounds, identify them. They could do, they could practice their exams and see what some of the findings should look like. The second thing that we did is we had a need to demonstrate for them clinical skills, specific skills, and we wanted to see that they could do them in return. So here's an example of one, which of course looks like an IM injection. This is on a doll, because that's how they're going to get started. Okay. But we also created a series of 9 videos that we wanted to demonstrate for them the approach to patients with certain kinds of problems. And so if we can link into that, I would like to show you a little piece of one of the videos that that we created. In order to teach this curriculum and to have people take care of patients, we have created a very involved community health aid manual. And it describes what they are supposed to do with histories and exams step by step. And what we did is to create a video for each of these exams that would show them what they were supposed to do step by step, and then they could replay it. So here's an example of the chest exam.
Examine the chest. Stop, look, listen, feel. Look at the appearance. Are there any retractions after the skin between the ribs pulls in the patient breathes in? Does the chest expand equally? Next, take your stethoscope and listen to the breath sounds. Compare one side to the other. Note if one side is quieter than normal, or one side is different from the other. Listen to the middle lobe. This is located under the right armpit. Listen in the front. Again, comparing one side to the other. Are the breath sounds you are hearing normal? Or are you hearing the wheezes, which sound like a whistling? Snoring sounds or crackles. Do any of the noises change or go away after the patient coughs? If you are hearing noises, ask the patient to cough and listen again.
I just want to give you a flavor of what these videotapes were like, and they could go back on the website and play these over and over again. They could re-listen to the sounds. They could see where their hand placements were. They go back to their manual and they find the directions and they follow it along with their manual. Okay. We also then would have them, after they'd reviewed all this, come to a live video conference and they would demonstrate it. They'd bring a volunteer in and they'd show us the hands-on technique, and we could give them direct feedback. And then they would go, after they had all that preparation, they'd actually go and do it in their clinics and have some supervised practice with their supervisors who go out and make field visits to their villages. At the end of our course, then we would test these skills and we would measure them with the same measures we would do if they were in face-to-face training. Here's an example of part of the video where we can see the eardrum move, and we would have them see what does an eardrum look like when it has mobility. So in this case, we were doing both, and that's done on the telemedicine cart. Okay, so we saw that DVD. All right, the third activity that they do then is clinical patient encounters, and they have to get out and they have to see real patients with real problems and interview them, do exams, and figure out what's going on, and then figure out how to report it and how to put it in the medical record. Okay. So each of the patient encounters must be supervised by a licensed provider, and those are nurse practitioners, physician assistants, or physicians. They see patients in their own clinics at home. These are the people that they live around and the patients they're going to be taking care of once they're done training. Ordinarily, they come into our clinic and we see them in Anchorage at the big hospital there, and they don't know these people and they don't know their trainers, and it's a really kind of a frightening situation for them. So we believe that this would actually enhance their learning. After they were done with their patient encounters, they had to be documented and supervised, and those records had to be uploaded into our website, and we could give prompt feedback on their medical record documentation so that they could improve it from time to time. Fourth objective for this course is to describe the impact this distance learning has had on their community health aides and on the health of the Alaska Native villages. Our students' population in our training is small on purpose, and it is because we give one-on-one feedback and instruction to their skills, and we've had the advantage of having them face-to-face and be able to put their hands where we want them to be. And this is what most of the skepticism was. Could we really do this through distance learning? So we had two cohorts go through the distance learning course that we put together. And the total that actually took the course between the two cohorts was 15 students. In a face-to-face training, that would have been 12 students. Out of the 15 students, 11 actually completed the course, and out of that, 9 passed and 2 did not. And that's somewhat similar to our experience in face-to-face training on 12 students that we would have come in. Okay. The findings then between distance education and traditional face-to-face education, this was very important for us to figure out, did we do at least as good a job, if not a better job, through distance learning? Is it worthwhile putting the investment in the technology? And one of the things we proposed is that what we wanted to do is get them into training sooner than they usually would. And one of the problems is we have a huge backlog and turnover of health aides at the beginning entry level. And one of the reasons for that is we have so few training slots and so many students that need training, there's a wait to get into our training. So these our students are hired, and then they work in the clinic doing assisting kind of work until they can get to training, and the average of our students, they would have had to wait upwards of a year to get into our training program, and a year where you employ somebody who's not doing the job you want them to do is time that's very hard to explain. So this is where a lot of the unrest in the tribal agencies came from. So we believe that by putting a distance learning program together, we could get them into training sooner. And actually, it turned out that they were able, all of them, to get their first training session in through distance learning under 3 months from date of hire to enter of training. And that was what we were shooting for. After training, we have a process of evaluating individuals, and we create something called post-session learning needs. And each individual then has some skills that are unique to them that they need extra practice on. We wanted to see if our students did at least as well and had the same kind of needs as face-to-face training, and it turns out there's no significant difference in what they need to practice between sessions. The consensus of our staff then was we wanted to poll our staff when the distance learning students came in for their next round of training. So they spend a month in face-to-face training. They spent more like 3 months in the distance learning session one. We wanted to see, did they come in with the equivalent experience between sessions? Were they equally capable of taking off where they left off and going on to the next session? And this And the consensus of our staff was that the students that came in from the distance learning course were much more confident in their skills and in their ability to go in and take on patients and their problems than many of our face-to-face training students were. Okay. The other thing is they had a much more consistent and thorough use of their health aid manual. And this is a picture of the manual. It's actually four volumes of it, which is an algorithm approach to patient problems and very specific directions and diagrams of how to do each part of patient care for primary care. We tested them online and in practical exams on video conferences, and the results we got on their final exams were very comparable. So in putting together those two cohorts of training, we drew some conclusions. In fact, the list of conclusions could probably fill an entire book by this point. But there's some implications for the future of distance learning as a training methodology. We felt that the results, that the successes our students had, was that entry-level health aides can definitely be taught these skills over distance technology with a minimal disruption to their community and subsistence way of life, and that makes them happier and it keeps them on the job longer. So we were hoping that this would reduce the turnover rate. And it suggests that this can be a very successful adjunct to the training center approach that we've been using for years, which actually has had an immense impact in improving the health status of natives in their villages. Okay. Implications for the future for our program is that we need to study more about this distance learning technology and what it can do in comparison to the traditional face-to-face training. So we need larger cohorts and more sessions. We need to start collecting data on these that we can start to make some conclusions based on retrospective evaluation of how they did. Two cohorts was the end of our pilot project. We're now trying to find ways to make this sustainable into the future. And we have a pretty effective team that we worked with, and now we need to see where that team can take us into the future. Distance technology, we believe, did prepare our students equally well, if not in some cases better. They were able to get further into the content. And the availability of distance learning for them as a choice did significantly decrease the time from hire to the start of training. And all who passed our course of distance learning are all still working, and that's 2 years out from their date of hire. And in many cases, we'd seen that students who had trouble getting into training quit long before they got this far. So people doing an unofficial poll of their employers, they are ecstatic with the level of activity that's going on with those particular students, and would like us to do more sessions, and I would like us to do more sessions as well. But the bottom line is that the residents of 9 villages in Alaska have improved access to health care because we have better trained and more of our community health aides out in the villages actually where their patients are. These are the contributors to our project. It was funded through grants, and the grants were to Eastern Aleutian tribes, and this is the names of some of the contributors who are part of the team. And there's myself at the bottom, and I was a partner with them, and I was the subject matter expert and the key instructor on this. And it was financed to create this distance learning network and put these courses on through grants from USDA and HRSA. And also from within our program, we had some program dollars put into it, the Denali Commission in Alaska and the University of Alaska, which contributed to the production of the videotapes. So if you'd like more information about this program, I have some names up here and of how you can contact us by email, which is probably the most effective way to get a hold of anybody these days. We're all into technology. And we also have the health aid program has its own website, which you might want to go into and see. It's being reconstructed right now to be a lot easier to maneuver through. But it's www.akchap.org. And even though it's in capitals here, it's not case sensitive, so you can put that in there. And there we are.
Thank you. I'd like to entertain questions for any of our speakers. And just to start it off, because I know you're all very shy at first, I'm interested in, since I had to go out of the room, and I apologize if this is a repeat, but can you tell me something about the videos that you made? Can you tell us what the cost per minute was, if you have that knowledge, or you know, who did you get for a director, and what were the complications and that kind of thing? Since you both did show videos, I'm very interested. So if you could both address that.
Sure. Our video cost about $5,000 to make, and we actually had some leftover grant funding that we used for that, and it was done in coordination with the Maine Medical Center for Outcomes Research and Evaluation. So we had a program evaluation specialist who was coordinating that process, and a videographer who was actually like a friend of a friend, so he was very reasonable. We shot the video over about a week's time, just getting the B-roll footage, the interviews with the patients, and then they probably did editing for about 2 weeks after that. There were no major problems or issues with the production. I'm sorry?
$5,000
for the whole video, yeah. The guy was real reasonable. Yeah, the question was about sustainability and maintaining funding. We continue to have a very active asthma program, and so we are using that work as the foundation, and we're continuing to meet with those partners to do, we get them together every once in a while to continue the work, but they're all sort of got them to a place where now they've implemented a lot of those changes, and we are touching base every once in a while. We're continuing to spread the work of the asthma program into other areas of the community as well, so that it really is disseminated throughout Greater Portland, and then working to spread it throughout the 11 counties in Maine as well. And our funding comes primarily through the health system. So we're a nonprofit. We have member hospitals who essentially pay a dues to be part of our system, and then we get part of their revenues. It's a percentage that goes into the clinical quality improvement. So we're system funded, and then we tend to layer on additional grant support for projects like this where we want to test interventions.
And I'll answer the video question. For our program, we created original videos, and we did 9 specific videos. And the team of instructors, Cass Healy and myself, we wrote the scripts based on the directions of the health aid manuals for those specific skills. The funding was actually offered to us from a combination of the University of Alaska, who was looking for a way to support the distance learning for our health aides, and the Denali Commission, who they brought $30,000 to bear for this and said, what would you like to do with it? And you know, who can figure that, right? But we had already started our training, and we were getting ready to start our first class, and we said, my gosh, I don't know where we're going to find the time to do this. But we did it anyway. We created 9 videos while we were giving the class, and we videotaped ourselves with volunteer patients, and we did. We had the University of Alaska had a something called their e-media group, who actually did the videotaping there at our training center. And after they were done the raw footage, then we had a contractor work on the post-production work, and I went through with him and I edited it out, and he put it all together and put all the little bullets and the labels and things in. It's pretty raw video as far as it goes, but it's very specific to our clients and the objectives for their training. So it was quite a collaborative effort amongst a number of us to spend $30,000 well, and we think that the 9 videos then are embedded in their website, so when they get to the specific areas of their training, they click on the videos with specific assignments, they watch them, they can repeat them as much as they like, and then we made video copies that we could mail out to the clinics, and they could be used for other forms of follow-up training, because the skills are expected to be consistent throughout all of the health aid training and their actual practice. The post-production work actually always seems to take the longest and it's the most costly. So I would imagine most of that money went to the contractor to do the post-production work. We just did ours under salary, so we're the actors there. And we didn't get paid any actors' equity fee, I can tell you that. But the videos now, we're looking for other ways to use them other than just on this website. And so to use them in specific face-to-face training as well is the next piece we're going to do with it. But you saw the one we have for the respiratory exam, for respiratory problems. We have one for ear problems, what they're supposed to do, that's more specific to how to look at ears and describe findings. We have musculoskeletal emergency treatment skills. We have the sick child screening physical exam. And I could list all the others, but probably will not for the sake of time.
Do we have any other questions? In that case, I'd like to give another round of applause to our speakers and thank them very much for their wonderful efforts. Sorry I had to leave in the middle of yours, but I caught quite a bit of it. I'd also like to remind you that the next session in here is going to be on Winter Soldier. It's about American soldiers against the war in Iraq. So it's 60 minutes. It should be quite exciting to look at. So please come. And thank you very much.
I'm just messing around.
And my name is